We'll have time for both of them. And then in between that, for a future presentation or so, we will have a new episode of Suspense, the new episode of the new Suspense, known as That Which Has a Name. And so that ought to round out our hour fairly robustly. So let's get started. Sit back, relax, and enjoy some spoken word entertainment here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Tune in to Too Dreamy, Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR, featuring music from local female and non-binary musicians and some sweet bedroom pop tunes.
The Study and Go Abroad Fair is back in town on Sunday, September 29th at the Vancouver Convention Center, East Building. Meet face-to-face with top universities from around the world. Learn about degrees in law, medicine, health sciences, arts, technology, pharmacy, business, hotel management, and much more. Check out the Travel Zone for internships, language travel, and work abroad. For more info, visit www.studyandgoabroad.com. Admission is free.
Hello, gentle listener, and welcome to Nocturnal Transmissions, the fortnightly podcast that brings you dark tales, both old and new, performed by voice artists. Kristen Holland. Spider-Man. Spider-Man. Does whatever a spider can. Spins a web. Any size. Catches thieves. Just like flies. Look out. Here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there. There goes the Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Wealth and fame he ignores, action is his reward. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man. You know, there are 40,000 species of spider that inhabit this little blue world of ours, as opposed to how many species of you, gentle listener? Why, one, of course. Just the one. Perhaps we should show them a little respect. I mean, after all, what is the alternative? I believe that Alice Cooper can best answer that very nearly rhetorical question. These words he speaks are true. We're all humanary stew, if we don't pledge allegiance to the Black Widow. You know what, though, listeners? The widespread belief that our arachnid fellow travelers mean us harm is surely a misconception. Was it not the Hopi Native Americans who told us of Spider Grandmother, whose quietly whispered words of guidance and wisdom helped many a hero of myth emerge victorious from perilous adventure? She, the intermediary between us poor lumps of clay and the divine. What would we do without her? And tell me, gentle listener, who is the best superhero of them all, Is it Superman? Yawn. Is it Batman? Really, who would want to be him? I think we all know who the best superhero is, who our younger comic book reading selves loved most of all. I'm sorry, am I rambling? Or am I just padding? To increase the length of this otherwise very short episode. I wonder. Nocturnal Transmissions is proud to present Jack Afon Reese's My Neighbor's Just a Giant Spider in a Trench Coat. My neighbor's just a giant spider in a trench coat. Not giant like those foot-long ones in South America. I mean he's 6 foot tall, standing on his hind legs. I think he thinks he's getting away with the ruse, too. But he's so bad at it. It'd be one thing if he wore a mask of human skin or something, or even more clothes under the trench coat. To be fair, sometimes he wears a hat, too, but he's not putting anywhere near enough effort into his disguise to warrant the level of confidence he possesses. And he forgets the basics. Like, the other day, I passed him in the hall, and we waved at each other. He waved at me, with three of his legs. We both stopped when it happened. We turned around and looked into each other's eyes for a moment. I stared into those eight eyes, wondering if I should finally say something. He waved at me again, this time with one leg. I nodded and moved on. I looked back at him, though, and he used one of his legs to wipe his forehead, like in mock relief that he didn't get caught. Everyone's way too nice to him. Not only in person, that I get, because you're terrified he'll wrap you in webbing and slowly devour you. But we're friends on Facebook, and everyone is always so effing nice to the guy. He posts the most basic shit you've ever seen. Like a picture of several of his legs stretched out on a beach chair holding a beer. And it'll say, hashtag blessed. And people comment, wish I was there, or save one for me. I came so close to writing, you're a giant spider. Can your body even process alcohol? Spiders don't have livers. But I stopped myself. We have a few mutual friends in the building, and I didn't want to be that guy who's always causing drama. I'm getting all worked up writing about it, though. I'm going to talk to him about it. Not be a dick. Be like, hey, I know you're a giant spider. Stop pretending you're not. I'm doing it now. So, knocked on his door, and he answered, wearing a bathrobe, which is, I guess, what he wears when he's home. I asked if we could talk in private, indicating I wanted to come in, but he shooed me back, not wanting me to come inside. The door was only open a crack. "You're a giant spider," I whispered. "It's like really obvious, too." He stared at me for a moment, then invited me into his place. I wish I hadn't gone in. I wish I'd kept my stupid mouth shut. His apartment was covered in web. It stretched everywhere, in all directions, but that's not all that was there. Taking up the bulk of the space was a gargantuan spider. She had to be over 20 feet wide, and she made no pretense at being human. She gazed at me as I entered their apartment. A substance dripped from her fangs as my steps caused web to vibrate throughout the space. My eyes searched around, not wanting to look at her. A wedding picture of the two of them hung on one of the walls. I looked back to the spider in the bathrobe. "Oh, this must be your lovely wife you're always talking about," I said. "It's so nice to finally meet you." I walked back towards the door. "You know, it's getting late. I'm not sure if I do have time for a beer after all. Maybe some other time." The spider in the bathrobe let me by him. Let me go back out the door. Before he closed it, he waved goodbye to me. With three legs. My Neighbor's Just a Giant Spider in a Trench Coat by Jack Afon Rees. You can find out more about Mr. Rees in the featured authors section of our website, nocturnaltransmissions.com.au. And now, ladies and gentlemen, a brief announcement. Just Entertainment presents A Story of Desperation and Suspense, an auditory thrill ride of intrigue and mystery that unravels fact from fiction in the exploration of truth amid a world of monsters and men. The Yowie Podcast, an audio suspense thriller in 5 parts, is now available, featuring our humble narrator, Kristen Holland, as series announcer. Find it wherever you find good serialized podcasts, or visit yowiepodcast.com. Well, that ends this fortnight's frivolity. All voices and production are concocted by Kristen Holland. All non-public domain stories are featured with the permission of the authors. Until next time, as always, watch the skies, fear the dark, and don't trust anyone, especially yourself. Good night, gentle listener.
Tune in to Too Dreamy Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR, featuring music from local female and non-binary musicians and some sweet bedroom pop tunes.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Dr. Brightfall?
Yes, you must be Ambassador Karstadt.
Only because no one else wants to be right now.
No, it's not as bad as all that, is it?
You'll find out soon enough. If you'll follow me, we'll brief you on the situation, unless you'd like to freshen up first.
No, let's get right to it.
Very good. I'll have your bags taken to your quarters. So, how was your flight?
I hate space travel. I get free-fall sickness, anti-gravity sickness, hyperdrive sickness, altitude sickness.
Have you always been like that?
Always.
You definitely picked the wrong line of work. The Colonial Service must keep you jumping from planet to planet, putting out fires.
It does. And that's why I joined in the first place. I love the challenge of dealing with different races, different cultures.
So you put up with the travel as a necessary evil?
Exactly.
Ah, here we are. Dr. Brightfall, please let me introduce our military liaison, Captain Connors.
Doctor? Captain?
And our science liaison, Dr. Wilford.
Doctor?
Doctor? Well, what can you tell me about the native population?
We refer to them as Baldersonites after the astronomer who first discovered this world.
That's a mouthful. They don't have a name for their own people?
They don't. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of things they don't have.
Yes. Industry, government, population centers, even agriculture.
They have none of the hallmarks of civilization?
Nope.
So the Baldersonites are a pastoral race?
As pastoral as Adam and Eve, and who could blame them? Balderson is a veritable paradise. Temperate climate, year-round balanced rainfall, a bounty of naturally growing fruits and vegetables.
And absolutely no predatory species on the entire planet.
None at all. What about conflict between groups of Baldersonites?
None. Ever.
Since there aren't any groups of Baldersonites to come into conflict with each other.
Then what about individual quarrels?
Over what? No one has anything.
To be more accurate, with no needs beyond food, which grows plentifully everywhere, and no desire or interest in anything else, what is there to fight about?
What about disease, illness?
All but unheard of, other than the occasional accident, you know, hit with a falling tree branch or something of that sort. The Baldersonites virtually never die of anything but old age. And their life cycle is substantially longer than ours. My guess is somewhere around 6 centuries.
I don't understand. With no limiting factors on population growth, and with ample leisure time for purposes of procreation, Balderson should have a population of, what, billions?
Uh-huh. And yet we estimate the actual number of Baldersonites to be no more than 5,000, scattered over the entire planet.
But how?
My working theory, which is supported by anecdotal evidence from the natives themselves, is that there's some sort of genetic marker in their DNA that recognizes when one of their species has died. Only then will a limited number of adults become capable of procreating. And once a pregnancy has taken place, those adults revert to a natural state of sterility.
That's incredible.
Don't ask me how it works. My guess would be some sort of subconscious psychic link. But that's all it is, a guess.
I think I already know the answer to this, but what about military capabilities?
No, they're not just pacifists. The idea of violence simply doesn't exist on Balderson. And even if it did, they'd be negligible opponents. The typical Baldersonite is perhaps 3 feet high and 50 pounds. We have a platoon of space marines on board. If we decided to just take the vast amounts of rare elements on Balderson, there is nothing they could do about it.
Captain Connors, I'm shocked to hear you say that.
Shocked?
I'm simply stating a fact.
Yes, well, that's not how we do things in the Terran Colonial Service. Our mission is to show the inhabitants of other worlds the benefits of trading with Earth, not to steal from them at blaster point.
The Baldersonites, are they humanoid?
Very much so. Bipedal, thin layer of fur, slightly built, surprisingly intelligent. They've already learned English, to the extent that we no longer have to use the Universal Translator.
Ambassador, what methods have you used in negotiations thus far?
Just the usual. Make initial contact, then try to barter for mining rights. But it's no good. The Baldersonites don't want anything.
Then we have to create the need.
Huh?
You'll see. Do we have a builds all on board?
Of course. It's standard procedure to have a robotic construction unit on contact vessels. Why?
I hope it's been recently serviced, because it's going to get a workout. I'm going to implement Operation Kickstand.
Operation Kickstand? I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, you will be, Ambassador. You will be.
Are you quite sure you don't want me to go with you, Dr. Brightfall?
Thank you, Ambassador, but the Baldersonites have already come to associate you with one sort of approach, so it's better that I go alone and start with a blank slate.
I understand. Good luck, Doctor.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. What's your name?
Name?
Yes, the particular word used to identify you to others.
Identify me as what?
As you.
Why would I need that?
You mean you all don't have names? How do you identify each other?
We just know.
Well, would you mind if I gave you a name so I can identify you?
Okay.
I'll call you Keegan.
Keegan. Keegan. Oh, there is my friend. Hello.
Hello.
I have a name now.
A what?
A name. A particular word used to identify me to others. I am Keegan.
Ooh, pretty. I want to be Keegan, too!
All right. Keegan!
Thank you, Keegan!
You are welcome, Keegan!
No, giving you names to distinguish you from others of your kind doesn't help if you all end up with the same name. How about if you are Keegan and you are Keevan?
Ooh, Keevan is a pretty name!
Oh, yes! I would like to be Keevan, too!
No, you need to be Keegan, okay?
Okay.
Oh, and here, I'd like to give you both something else.
Give us something else?
Yes, a gift. Here, this is for you, Keegan.
What is it?
It's called a balloon.
Balloon.
See, you blow into it like this. Then you tie it shut. See?
Balloon! Balloon!
this is a gift for you, Kievan.
Ooh, what is it?
It's called bubblegum.
Bubblegum.
See, you open it, and you put it in your mouth, and chew it, and then you blow out like this. And you can do it over and over again.
It is like a balloon that you can make over and over again.
Yes. Well, I must be going, but I will come back tomorrow, okay?
Okay, okay.
Hello.
Hello. What do you have for Kievan today?
Yes, what do you have for Kievan today?
Oh, what a beautiful afternoon. Isn't it a beautiful afternoon?
Yes, yes. Beautiful afternoon.
And that necklace I brought you last week, Kievan, really picks up the light.
Yes, very beautiful. What do you have for Kievan today?
But then, so does that glittery shirt I brought you the other day, Kievan.
Hurry before others come!
Well, I have this.
Ooh! What is it?
It's called a kaleidoscope.
Kaleidoscope.
That's right. You look into it like this, and you can see colors inside.
Colors?
Yes, all the colors of the rainbow, and always changing. To make it change, you just turn the cylinder like this.
Ooh.
But I only have the one.
Give kaleidoscope to Kievan. Give something else to Kievan.
No, Kievan wants kaleidoscope.
Kievan saw it first.
Did not.
Did too.
Did not.
Did too.
It looks like a lot of your friends are coming. They might want it for themselves.
Kievan,
hey! Give that to Kievan!
It's been 3 weeks since I implemented Operation Kickstand. Phase one, the introduction of consumerism under the guise of gifts, went even better than I could have imagined. The Baldersonites quite literally can't get enough of the trinkets I've been giving them.
But we tried bartering with them when we first arrived, and the consumer goods we offered them in exchange for mining rights were, if anything, more valuable than the junk you've been handing out.
There's a subtle difference, however. You tried trading with them, convincing them to give you something in exchange for something else. It didn't work simply because the Baldersonites had no concept of individual ownership. They couldn't trade with you because none of them understood the idea of possessing something. Giving them items as gifts laid the groundwork for phase two, reinforcement of individual ownership. I began giving gifts only to some of the Baldersonites. You can guess what happened.
Yes, I can guess.
Now, we can enter phase three, in which we inform the Baldersonites that we can only continue to give them gifts if we receive a gift in return. Mining rights. Given how obsessive they've become about the baubles we supply them with, they'll almost certainly agree. In essence, we've taken a people who were totally content to walk and convinced them they need bicycles. And now we're going to sell them the kickstands to keep their bicycles upright.
Bicycles?
An archaic mode of transportation.
I don't know what to say.
It would have been more humane to just take their resources at Blaster Point.
Captain. You'll have to excuse Captain Connors. She's new to the Colonial Service, so she hasn't learned how things get done yet.
Operation Kickstand is just an extension of what used to be common practice among old Earth political constructs such as the Roman, British, and American empires. We simply expanded on it, since the Baldersonites were vastly less sophisticated than even the most backwards Bronze Age tribes.
As an advanced culture, it's our duty to introduce our more primitive brethren to civilization.
Uh-huh. And make off with anything of value on their planet in the process.
Nothing that they'll ever miss.
Except quiet, clean air, simplicity of existence.
There's always a price to be paid for progress.
If that's what you call it.
Dr. Brightfall.
I'm not here to judge the ethics involved. The Colonial Service gives me challenging situations, and I solve them to the best of my ability, regardless of whether I personally agree with the solutions or not. Captain Connors, as a Marine officer, surely you understand that.
Oh, I understand it, Doctor. But a gun is a lot more honest than any words can be.
This isn't open to debate, Captain. It's done.
Exactly. And speaking of which, Ambassador, I believe the Baldersonites are ready for your negotiations. We can begin whenever you're ready.
No time like the present, then. We'll go down to the surface in 1 hour. What the devil? An enormous pile of... Dr. Brightfall, aren't those all the trinkets you've been giving to the Baldersonites?
They are, but... why? Hello?
Hello.
Keegan, why are all my gifts here in a big pile? Wait, where is Keevan? She's almost always close by you.
Keevan was running because others wanted her kaleidoscope. She fell, hit her head on a rock.
Oh no. Poor Keevan. I'm so sorry. But why are you giving back the gifts? Don't you want them?
It is our fault. We should not have them, because we do not know how to use them. So we return them to you.
But what about the mining rights?
You can have mining rights. Our gift to you. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Keegan.
Well, seems the congratulations are in order, Dr. Brightfall.
Congratulations? For what?
For closing the mining rights deal.
But Operation Kickstand didn't work.
What do you mean it didn't work? We got what we wanted, didn't we?
And what about the Baldersonites? What did they get?
We offered them civilization. It's not our fault that they gave it back.
Yeah? Well, I think we were just taught a lesson on civilization by a naked 3-foot savage.
So ends Operation Kickstand by John C. Alsodek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was written especially for Suspense by John C. Alsodek and Dana Perry Hayes. Anjali Bimani was Dr. Brightfall. Venice Parker was Keegan. Joe Ackman was Ambassador Karlstadt. Adrian Wilkinson was Captain Connors. Steve Moulton was Dr. Wilford. And Deneen Melody was Keevan. I'm John C. Alsodek. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism. as opposed to someone who buys like you know, let's say someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture. And that's been around for centuries.
Hello, gentle listener, and welcome to Nocturnal Transmissions, the fortnightly podcast that brings you dark tales, both old and new, performed by voice artist Kristen Holland. I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Whitney Houston. Let's save the children. Marvin Gaye. I want to kill people. I want to rip their stomachs out and eat their children. Mike Tyson. Our featured tale this time around is entitled For the Children. Gentle listener, it is not. We do hope you enjoy Holden Mars's For the Children. He felt a heat flush his face, cheeks full of blood as he lumbered up the steps of the metal fire escape, a gas can in each hand. His pulse grew erratic as the full realization of what he was there for sank in. He was having an out-of-body experience. But he wasn't hovering over himself. He was hundreds of yards away in the dark, gazing through a telescope at his own feverish body. He came back to his consciousness in a rush and found himself looking through a window at the family within. Son, daughter, mother and infant. Father. They played a game together and enjoyed each other's presence, the room full of familial spirit. Suddenly, his heart grew heavy with regret for what he had to do. He hesitated. He knew he was sick. In the distance, he heard the blades of a police helicopter chopping the brisk city air. Maybe he should turn himself in. They could get him help, get him a doctor. Instantly, he was looking through a window made of time. He saw himself in that room. Just a child, as he looked down the barrel of a loaded revolver. His father's finger on the trigger. His mother's body, bloody and broken, lifeless in the doorway. He couldn't move. Couldn't breathe as he watched his father's thumb cock the hammer. His own breath choked him as he heard the clicks of the gun. A scream tore itself from his throat as the chambers rotated, and that hammer fell. And, as abruptly as it started, the memory was gone, replaced with the happy lie he had observed moments before. Sweat covered his being. It soaked into his clothes and plastered his hair to his face. His grip on the gas cans tightened, and in that moment, he knew he couldn't let those kids go through that same betrayal. So on he lumbered, and below him, the city was alive. Ants scurried without purpose beneath incandescent suns, and great mechanized scarabs shuffled about in an endless dance. Their mechanical clicks and whirs and horns clashed with the ants' organic cries and created a cacophony of energy, a capitalistic orchestra conducted by demons inside translucent monoliths of steel and mirrored glass. As he traversed one of the fire escape's landings, two cries gained clarity above the rest, shouting from the apartment next to him. He paused a moment to listen.
"Are you really going to start this shit with the dishes again?"
a man shouted.
"I just want you to do them for once in your miserable life, Jerry."
A woman roared back.
"Well, maybe my life wouldn't be so miserable if I wasn't married to such a stupid, frigid bitch,"
he returned.
"My mother was right. I should have just married David when I had the chance. Then I wouldn't be stuck in this shithole with you."
In the midst of the yelling, a compulsion gripped him, and though he tried, he could not resist as he gazed into the apartment. As his eyes gravitated between the curtains, he was again transported into memory and saw his parents. His father towered over his mother as she cowered beneath his massive frame.
"What the fuck did you just say to me?"
his father bellowed.
"What did you just say, you stupid bitch?"
His mother tried to answer, but her words were beaten down by the back of his hand. As she hit the floor, he was upon her, yanking her up by her beautiful hair as she howled in pain.
"You don't ever talk back to me! I'm the best fucking thing you've got, and you know it! Without me, you wouldn't even have this shithole! You'd be out on the goddamn streets! Don't you ever!"
His father's shouting grew ever louder as he struck her over and over and over. Her cries pleading for help, desperately trying to touch the ears of anyone who could listen. His callous fists desecrated her delicate body, reducing her to a quivering, sobbing pile of flesh and bone without value in this civilized world. Outside, his muscles seized, his joints ossified, and he was frozen on the fire escape. The wind cut his eyes as he was forced to watch, while his father destroyed his mother. Her cries became weaker and more infrequent. Eventually, they ceased altogether, and he stared, eyes bulging and mouth agape, as his father dropped her lifeless form in the doorway. Suddenly, his father's body tensed. Through a predatory sixth sense, the beast felt the presence of prey. He straightened and turned slowly. Their eyes locked, and his visage twisted with a monstrous rage as he began a slow march towards the window.
"What the fuck are you doing out of your room, Charles?"
his father roared. His face continued its unholy contortions as it pulled colors from the walls and sucked light from the lamps.
"Who the fuck told you that you could leave your room? Huh? Answer me when I'm talking to you!"
His father's voice deepened and warped into a demonic squeal that grated on his very soul. The ants were shrieking beneath his skin, consuming him from the inside, while the scarabs made their way up his body, tilling his flesh with their steely limbs. He shut his eyes and ears as he tried desperately to end it. His heart pounded and left a vacuum in his tightening chest as he fell to his knees. His blood roared deafeningly,
and his father's luciferic snarls grew in intensity. They filled his head and battled within its confines, each growing louder and louder and louder and louder until he felt his skull split apart by their feudal volume. The noises cut off with a jarring abruptness, and his eye snapped open as he collapsed on all fours, his fingers woven through the metal grate in a white-knuckled grip as he frantically sucked in the oxygen his father had deprived him of moments prior. His condition was deteriorating. The memories were becoming too real, becoming far too real. He didn't have much time. He forced himself to his feet and collected the gas cans with trembling hands. He had to keep moving. No more detours. No more windows. The remaining flights passed without incident, and as he ascended the final stairway, his body cried out in protest. His triceps burned with anaerobic fire. His shoulders begged for rest, and his legs and lower back filled with a deadened ache. But the knowledge that it was almost over, that this was his final trip, fueled him. It dulled the ache in his bones and quenched his muscles as he summited the building once more. As he mounted the rooftop and crossed to its center, he looked upon the multitude of spent gas cans that littered the gravel landscape. They looked like tombstones in some post-apocalyptic cemetery. As he navigated this graveyard, he tread lightly, so as not to awaken its inhabitants. He soon came to the end of his journey and stood before a great white metallic vacuole. A sign on its side shouted at him in big, bold block letters, "Caution." But he ignored it, and with practiced hand on the tank and uncapped the spout of one of the gas cans, he mated the two, and as the gasoline flowed and sloshed into its new vessel, his mind drifted to the innocents below, to the lives he was soon to end. No, he was not ending lives, but saving souls. Without him, every single being in this building would be thrown into the muck of modern society, condemned to life. Day by day, they would lose their sanity and everything they loved, helpless before the inevitability of their deterioration, until one day they were but a husk of their former selves. He would spare them those hardships and guide them through this life sentence. He would ferry them to the other side. Feeling the last of the gasoline slip into the tank, he threw the can behind him, now just another headstone, and replaced the cap. Given confidence by the sureness of the goodness of his deed, he smashed the lock that held the cover over the manual flush button. He flipped the cover up and placed his hand above the button. Tears of ambivalence welled in his eyes. But an image of the children in the apartment downstairs, those precious, innocent children, flashed through his mind. With a howl, he plunged down his hand and soon heard the bleat of the fire alarm as cries of confusion wafted on miasmic fumes. Tears stained his face as he wrenched open the last can of gasoline and held it above his head. The noxious liquid showered his body, invaded his nostrils with a searing agony, and sank into his skin through a hellish osmosis. As the last of the gasoline trickled down, he dropped the can to his feet, and with shaking hands pulled from his coat two items: a prepaid disposable phone and a silver Zippo. Gas seeped into his eyes and blinded him as his fingers fumbled across the keypad. He managed to punch in the right numbers, and immediately an explosion rocked the building. The first floor was engulfed in a cleansing fireball, followed quickly by the second and the third. He could hear the cries of confusion turn to cries of agony, and they tore into his heart. But he knew what he was doing was right. It was for the best. It was for them. As the blaze below leapt from floor to floor, he turned his attention to the lighter. A quick flick of the wrist, and it was open, ready for him to strike the flint and summon its unwavering flame. He took a moment's pause, prayed to a god he no longer believed in. Then down snapped his thumb, and up came that invincible pilot light. With an unholy swiftness, the fire spread across his body and engulfed him in a pain known only by the damned. Every single nerve in his body sizzled, popped, and shrieked at his sudden betrayal. He felt his skin and his clothes melt together, melding in an excruciating matrimony that brought him to his knees. Then, with a colossal roar and titanic groans, the building opened up beneath him and swallowed him into its gaping maw. For the Children by Holden Mars. If you'd like to find out more about this author,
you either been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money, the one you loved has deserted you, that makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue, right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, www.citr.ca. Code Blue.
Here's how he feels about it. Blues ain't nothing but a man, good man feeling bad, no how. That's all that is.
And you're tuned into CITR 101.9 FM. That was Nocturnal Transmission with both My Neighbors, Just a Spider in a Trench Coat, and For the Children. In between that, we had Operation Kick.